Okay, let's actually start backwards. The fascinating Rashi that it gets a little bit lost in the shuffle. A lot of the attention gets placed on Pinchas and Midyanim and Vinod Salafchad, and the census feels a little technical. But if you look carefully, there are a lot of very interesting phenomena, very interesting anomalies in the census. One of them is they're missing families. If you compare the census in Parshas Pinchas to the census in Parshas Naso, there are seven missing families. So Rashi notes these seven families, and let's see. There are five of Binyamin that are missing, because in Parshas Naso there are 10, and here there are only five. Itzvon of God is missing, so that's number six. And there's a missing family of Shimon named Ohad. So Itzvon of God, Ohad of Shimon, and then five other families are missing. So what happened? So Rashi says that when Aaron dies in Parshas Chukas, all of a sudden the Anani HaKavod dissipate. They vanish. So everyone freaks out. So they walk back seven stations from Hor HaHar to a place called Mosera. And this leads to a very quiet, almost concealed mutiny. Most of the mutinies in the desert are described, particularly the ones before 40 years. This happens after 40 years when Aaron dies, but for whatever reason, the Torah doesn't want to describe it to us. It would be too jarring. The Torah wants to paint a better picture of that post-40-year generation, even though Shittim is a catastrophe and Por is a catastrophe. So they're walking back seven stations. Seven families die. How do the seven families die? Because the B'nai Levi walk back and they battle. This is another civil war that breaks out. And the B'nai Levi are battling these groups of people. We don't know how many people, how large the contingent was, but the aftermath of that battle is seven families were lost. Seven families were wiped off of the census. And that's why those families are not listed in Parshas Pinchas. Now there's another problem. There were four families of B'nai Levi who are missing. We talked about there's one family of God that's missing in Pinchas from Nassau. There's one family of Shimon. There's five families of Binyamin. But if you look in Parshas Naso, there are four families of Levi that aren't quoted here. One is Shimi, Uzi Azieli, and Yitzhari. And there's a fourth one that Rashi says, I don't know who they are, but he has a sense that they're missing. Now, how did those four families of Levim go missing? So Rashi says, because that happened in the battle. In this battle, when the Jewish people walked back and retreated seven stations, so the B'nai Levi, once again, their normal role, B'nai Levi rose to the challenge, defending HaKadosh Baruch Hu, defending Emunah, in this case, defending Aaron HaKohen, because part of the death was the aftermath of Aaron's loss, and they didn't want this loss of their family representative to be for naught. So people started panicking and running back seven stations, the B'nai Levi interceded in the same way they would intercede in Parshas Kitisa with the Ego. Then Rashi quotes a Medr. So far everything is normal. It's not something we've seen before, because for whatever reason the Torah suppresses it, but it's a normal narrative. Namely, Aaron dies, people are panicked, they flee back seven stations, B'nai Levi intercede. Sadly, there's a civil war, but there was a civil war during the Ego, and there's casualties of that civil war. Seven families, four families of B'nai Levi, seven families from Binyamin, Shimon, and Dan. But now Rashi quotes a Tanchuma, which is really jarring. He says, no, that the four families that died of B'nai Levi, not sure whether Rashi means the four families or that one missing family, not clear, but at least one family of Shevet Levi died during the Pinchas episode. Namely, they were on the wrong side of the ledger. They died in the Magefa. They presumably were involved in this Nus and this Por, which is a very, very jarring image. Because normally, Levi's on the right side of the ledger. Normally, Levi isn't worshipping the eagle. Normally, Levi is not being condemned to this whole Magefa. That's why they weren't counted. And somehow, something switches. Somehow, though they were able to withhold and not participate in the Ego, and they were able to not be too involved in the Meraglim, because they didn't really have a Nasi in the Meraglim. So something happens here in the story of Pinchas and the tragedy of the Por that Levi dies in the Magefa, because presumably they're being drawn into this world of Chet where in the past they weren't. And the question is, what's different? What's different about Parshas Pinchas of B'nai Levi our Siddurs and to the Schet, where in the past they were always the stalwarts, they were always the holdouts, they were always the strong tribe. Now something about their mettle or their conviction wanes. So a couple things come to mind. The Medrash doesn't say. Possibly one is the Chet is different. The Chet until now was theological. Do you believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Do you believe in Eretz Yisrael? Do you have Emunah? Moshe is tarrying from descending. Can you still withhold your belief in HaKadosh Baruch Hu? The Chet of Pa'or is primarily sexual. It has a theological component. They end up worshiping, associating with the world of Pa'or, but the lead-in, the entry, is the Benos Moav. And it reminds us of the truth. It's a very, very different form of Yetzirah. It's a very, very different form of failure. If people, even in our world today, were very staunch, very pious, very theologically, all things being without, you know, obviously you can't call yourself staunchly committed if you have such a severe chet, but on all other fronts. And although they don't wander or worry theologically, sexual Yetzirah and sexual pressures can overcome the best of men. And it just teaches us how powerful this pressure is. And even B'nai Levi, who hadn't been involved in the Meraglim, who hadn't been involved in the Egel, who hadn't been condemned to death, even B'nai Levi get drawn into this world of Pa'or, and at least one family, maybe one, maybe four, it's not clear from Rashi, are decimated. Another question is, maybe Aaron HaKohen is dead without leadership, so maybe their ranks are in a bit more of a disarray and chaotic. They didn't have the Aaron to lead. By the way, it puts a whole new light on Pinchas. Pinchas is an act of defiance. He's defying the political echelon. He's defying Cusby and Zimri, and these are both respective leaders, one of the tribe of Shimon, one of Midian, and he's getting a lot of mockery and a lot of disdain, and Chazal tells about the disdain, so it's not just the physical act of bravery, but the ability to defy your society. But this Rashi basically frames the fact that Pinchas wasn't just defying his society, he was defying his own Sheva. Pinchas is a Levi, Pinchas is a Kohen. And they're actual Levim who are being drawn into this world of Pa'or. So it's not just other tribes and he comes back at home at night and he consorts with his B'nai Levi and they say, Pinchas, we have to stop this Magefa. You're our man. We support you. Go, here's a spear. And go spear Zimri. And go spear Cusby. This is Pinchas having to deal with not just the social disarray, but the disarray within his own Shevet, because part of Levi, at least one family, is being drawn into this fold. Part of it has to do with the absence of Aaron. Part of it may have to do, it's hard to know, with Shimon. Shimon was driving, at least Shimon seems to be part of this episode, because Zimri is in a sea of Beis Avos Shimoni. Now, what type of relationship do Shimon and Levi still have? Shimon and Levi were, of course, comrades in Parshas Vayishlach. Shimon and Levi are being critiqued jointly by Yaakov Avinu. Shimon and Levi achim, klechamas mecheresahem. So this is the first event in the Midbar which was driven by Shimon. All the other events, for example, Korach was driven by Reuven. There's one Shevet that's involved, Dasan and Aviram came from Reuven. So they were driven, it was a Reuven-based event. The other events, but now it's Shimon. Does Shimon still have sway over Levi? Do Shimon and Levi still have a very unique relationship where Shimon makes certain plans and once Shimon and once Zimri is leading this event, maybe Levi feels a little bit more drawn to it than they had earlier. It's unclear, but it's a very, very anomalous Rashi. Until now, Levi has always been the defenders of the faith, has always been the staunch protectors, the punishers, the people. And in fact, in the first story that Rashi quotes, that's the role they play. The Jewish people are panicked after Aaron dies, they retreat seven stations, and B'nai Levi intervene. At least according to Rashi's version, at least three families from B'nai Levi are eliminated or erased based on that interaction, based on that civil war. But there's one family that goes missing in B'nai Levi, and Rashi isn't able to account for them. And at least the Medrash and Chumash says that they die during the Pinchas episode, which really changes our view of what happened during Pinchas. Okay? Now, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to attack the Midianim, and Moshe delivers the command, Hashem uses a very interesting grammar, not an interesting word, but an interesting grammar. Saror es ha-Midianim b'kisem osam. You should entangle yourself with them. You should, what would be a good word for tsarar? It could either be tsara, to cause discomfort, to attack. It could also be the tsarar, to engage, when you're connected to something. What's fascinating is the language, tsarar. Why tsarar? So Rashi says it's similar to other languages that are present. Sometimes, I think in English it's called perfect present, where you say something in the present, but it means, here in English languages?
Yeah,
right. So what is it? Sar, in perfect present, we say something in the present, but it's an extension. It's a duration, right? Sar means a state of being. It's not a one-off action. A one-off action is described by a classic verb. Take the action, kachas aron achicha, krelem ijanim, say, speak, move. Here, sarar is a constant reality, awareness, consciousness, and Rashi compares it to zachor. Shamor. Now, of course, Zachor is cited twice. It's not clear which Zachor Rashi is referring to. He quotes Zachor v'Shamor, so he's probably referring to Zachor v'Shamor in the Aseret HaDibros. But what other Zachors could Rashi be referring to that's more directly connected to Tzerar? Amalek. Zachor is Hashas Zachal Amalek. Which means, don't just take an action, but it should be a continuous consciousness, because these are important concepts, not just activities. Activity, you perform the activity, then you're finished. But thinking about Shabbos, preserving Shabbos, thinking about Amalek's role in history and our battle with Amalek, it's not just when we're engaged in battle, but it has relevance and has application for our entire lives. So we recite Parshas Zachor on a yearly basis, even though we're no longer actively involved in the milchama with Amalek, because the consciousness and the awareness and the messages transcend the activity. So what are the messages of Midyan if it's being held up structurally similar to Amalek, and even structurally similar to Shabbos? Zachar, Shamor, Zachar, Yisrael, Amalek, Tzoros, and Midyanim. What could be so important? It says, we had an encounter. They were a little bit devious. We defeated them. And we went to war and payback and eliminating their influence. So the Pasuk tells us, and there really are two things. That's why there are two psukim. Tzoros, and Midyanim, Vikisem, also. Why? Ki tzarim heim lachem. Why are they tzaror? Why should you be involved in this constant tzaror? B'nichlehem asher niklu lachem al dvar po'or. That's what I said before. Because Rashi, now I'm reading Rashi, shehifkiru b'noseim liznus, because of the constant danger of the tzar of znus. So just remember, this is different. Po'or is different than the meraglim. Po'or is different than the eagle. Even b'nei Levi were victimized by this. But then Rashi also says, Shehefkiru b'noseim liznos. And Rashi quotes it a little bit earlier when the Torah describes that the woman's name was Kuzbi, and Kuzbi was the daughter of Tzur, and Tzur was a tribal leader, a base of the Midyan. Rashi says, Lo diamsin asan shal midyanim, Shehefkiru bas melech liznos. Namely, there's another message here that's important, and it's not just the danger of sexual impropriety and of the sexual yetzahara. And that is the fact that the Moavim donated, or the Megidim, I'm sorry, donated one of their princesses to this prostitutional setting. Remember, it was Benos Moav, but somehow Kuzbi from Midyan, the daughter of Tzur, the daughter of one of the tribal heads, makes her way to this carnival, makes her way to this orgy. Why is this important? It's one thing to say we have to constantly remember the Megidim because they captured or they exploited our sexual vulnerability. But why is this important? This is important because it shows the psychopathic nature of hatred in general and of anti-Semitism in particular. Hatred in general is such an intoxicating and such a confusing trait that when you really hate something or hate someone, you lose your mind. You lose your ration. You act totally abnormally. You act totally self-destructively. Chazal's language for this is Hasina Mikalkelis Asashura. That when you hate something or somebody, you can commit the most foolish and even self-destructive actions. When Bilam hates the Jewish people last week, so he's involved in the early morning saddling his donkey. The donkey's defecating, and the donkey is smelly in the harness. He must have stable hands. But Bilam arises early, because he's filled with hatred. When Paman is filled with hatred, he makes all the wrong moves, and he's blinded by his hatred. But it's even more true when it's about the Jews. It's even more true when it's anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is really a microcosm of human hatred. It's the worst human hatred. It's unique to Jews, but it also highlights how much human beings can hate one another. Arami Oved Avi, the Rav would always say. Simple pshat is referring to Lavan. Lavan Bigesh Lagos HaKol. Lavan was chasing Yaakov. In his mind, he's going to reach Yaakov's camp, and attack the camp and eliminate everyone in the camp. Exactly who's in the camp? Who's he warring with? His own daughters and grandchildren. His own daughters and grandchildren. One biggest lager sakol. But he would rather murder his entire family as long as he gets vengeance on Yaakov and he's able to eliminate this whole Jewish threat. Paro, the knight of Becharos, is being pleaded with by his own son, leading a team of Becharos, or pleading with Paro, release the Jewish people. All of Moshe's threats have materialized, and now we're in the crosshairs. And Paro would rather let his own son, his own flesh and blood, die than release the Jews. And then a civil war breaks out in Egypt because of that. 60,000 people die before Makas Becharos. Hitler in World War II. I don't know World War II history that well, but one thing I could tell you, had he not been adamant about chasing down every single last Jew in cellars in Budapest, the outcome of World War II would have been very, very different. He was fighting a double front war, and he had every single man in Stalingrad to face this wave of Russian attack, of millions of Russians that were attacking in Stalingrad. Had he just, if I were Chas v'Shalom committing genocide, I would first set my boundaries, conquer as much of Europe as I can, lock in my defenses, take control. I mean, he had pretty large swaths of Europe, but he decided to end the war. The Allies were reeling. The Allies were weak. He could have stopped the war. He has France on the west. He's got close to Russia on the east. Stop the war, build your defenses, then hunt down the Jews. But while he's fighting the Russians and while he's fighting the Allied forces in the west, all of a sudden he's chasing down Jews and the SS, and he has lists of 250 Albanian Jews. It's just hatred of the other and anti-Semitism is so self-destructive, it's psychopathic. You act in a self-destructive fashion. And you see that on display with Cosby. The last thing in the world is to send a princess out to be raped by drunk revelers in the Jewish camp. It's the last thing you want to do with your princess. Get some women off the street. Get some homeless women. Get some slave girls. Plenty of slave girls available. Moab just fought a war with Amori. There are plenty of women around to send to this orgy. And they're sending Cosby. They're sending one of the delicate, dainty, beautiful women to besmirch herself in this uncouth and vulgar environment, because that's how much the Midianim hated the Jews. You can see the hatred in the beginning of the Parshas Balak, and that's the lesson of Midian, the dual lessons of Midian. The reason that Midian is described in Amalek-like terms, Zachar is Zachar, Sarar is a Midianim, is because it's not just defeating Midian, it's about defeating these two ideas, it's remembering these two ideas that are captured by the Midian encounter. Number one, the danger of sexual vulnerability. Number two, the psychopathic nature of hatred in general and anti-Semitism in particular. And you actually see what happened to Midian, because the ramifications for Midian were severe. Because here, Cosby's father is called Tzur, and he's a Rosh Umos. But if you look a little bit later, when the actual war takes place, and it's described which kings fought in the war between the Jewish people and Midianim, the Torah writes in Perek Lamed Aleph, Evi, Rechem, and Tzur. Tzur is listed third. In our parasha, he's described as Rosh Beis Av. He's not just the leader, but he's the, not just the tribal leader, but he's the confederate leader. All the other tribes looked to Tzur for leadership and for guidance. But yet in the war, he's counted third. Evi, Rechem, and Tzur. He's the third tribal leader that's counted. Rashi says that all of his peers, they downgraded him. They impeached him. Say, so you're a leader, and you're sending your own daughter to this orgy? So it ended up having deep political impact. His hatred of the Jews set him and his political interests back. He was the Rosh Beis Av, but after this episode, he was demoted to be just number three. Evi and Rechem usurped him. Because I just couldn't imagine this error in judgment, this miscalculation. Why would you be so hateful? It's not just the miscalculation, but they sense the hate in him, and he could no longer be fit for the leader. That's what's on display in the confrontation with Midian. That's why the word Tzur is described. It should be a constant recognition, a constant process, not just a one-off war with Midian. Those are the two Rashis. One is the missing family of Levi. There are seven missing families because of the war of Levi during the Great Retreat. Levi loses three families during that war of retreat, but there's one family that goes missing the Rashi can't account for. He quotes Medrash Tanhuma that at least one family, maybe even other families of Levi, were drawn to the Peor catastrophe, and they died at Peor along with the 24,000. Which is a very, very shocking switch in the narrative of the rest of the Torah. It's hard to know why. Second issue is the psychopathic nature of Midian's behavior, as well as the overwhelming danger of sexual vulnerability are the reasons that this fight with Midian, this war with Midian, is not just a local skirmish to avenge ourselves for our opponents, but has larger ramifications to religion, and therefore the word Tzvor is employed. Shabbat Shalom.
I think it's towards the end of the second half.